Author of the Week, with Jessica Burtis, Rebecca Bond, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
Well, if there was ever such a thing, as indeed there is, of a fabulous foursome of romantic writers, then probably Stuart Perrin, Curtis and Webb would actually serve as that template. We've already spoken in previous podcasts to, of course, the awesome Anna J. Stewart and, of course, Carrie Lynn Webb. And now, of course, even more wonderful times have actually emerged because one of that fabulous foursome of USA Today best-selling authors is indeed with us at this very moment on Author of the Week. It's Melinda Curtis. How are you, Melinda?
Hi, I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to connect with you, good soul. You see, clearly, that notion about the old Fab Four being Meghan and Harry and William and Kate, etc. No, it was always going to be yourself and the rest of the gals. Really, that's the real Fab Four. So we know this. We know it's important.
That's the real Fab Four.
Yeah, you move from obviously being a fabulous junior manager for a Fortune 500 company to a best-selling author. But I love the tale of how you can know that you're a junior manager with a Fortune 500 company. You get the potty seat on the plane.
Yeah, you know, Fortune 500 companies have access to a lot of private jets. And so when
That's why they're Fortune 500, Linda.
Yes, when I traveled with senior management, there were six seats in the plane. There's the pilot and the co-pilot. And then there was the potty, which had walls and a curtain and a seat belt. And so the junior person almost always got the potty. And there was a little pad like you would buy, you know, at the store, just put in your chair, little pad you put on top of it. And thankfully, no one ever needed to use it while it was my seat. But I did become a very good at falling asleep on the potty.
Yeah, it just shows, you see, some of the stresses and strains that capitalism can bring to the world. I don't know. Let's talk about your fabulous writing, of course, because Sunshine Valley is one of the sort of key things. Is it a case of you wake up in the morning, you think, I'm going to be romantic today. I'm going to write some wonderful, mellifluous prose. I'm going to put all things together. Or is it a case of, like all writing, you have to work at it?
You have to really work at it. I think what I love about the romance genre is not the hot, steamy stuff. I mean, I started out writing that, but I really love how people find themselves when they find that one person that completes them, you know?
Yeah, it's that sort of thing, which ever since the days of ancient Greece, where we were split into that sort of connected in all sorts of ways. Many people might say that person is actually in North Carolina. But anyway, that's just by the by. Jessica Burtis has joined us from the aforementioned North Carolina. How are you, Jessica? She will unmute herself eventually, Melinda. It's just a minor point. If she unmutes herself, all will be well. Lip reading works so well on Zoom. Anyway, welcome along, Jessica. How are you?
Thank you. I'm pretty good. Me and myself might help. I hope you guys can't hear all the traffic outside. There's a lot of like rain going on in cars. Is everything okay?
A rainy day in North Carolina. I can't believe that. That's most unusual. have you actually got any initial questions you'd like to put to Melinda about her life and her awesome work?
Well, first I'd like to ask, where are you located out of curiosity?
Well, my husband and I moved from California to Oregon during the shutdown, which was, I wouldn't advise that for anybody, because a shutdown means when you're traveling 10 hours driving a moving truck that there are not going to be any clean toilets to take a break. This seems to be a theme, Alex, me and potties.
I was going to mention it, Melinda,
so we moved to Oregon. I'm into a fixer and I'm currently in my laundry room. As you could tell, lovely background.
I thought that was a virtual laundry room that you'd set us up in, Melinda, just to actually carry the ambience. I mean, yeah, it's fair to say people would kill for that. Right. Look at my tarsen rug.
I had a perfect setup and the wrong payoff. So yeah, this is the only room right now that has complete walls and a door with a knob on it. So yeah. So here I am in Oregon.
Maybe there's a fixer-upper romance in the future.
Maybe there is, but it would have to also have a bakery and what else? Hot chocolate?
Yes.
I can see these critical ingredients coming together. So, yeah, enough about the potties, Melinda. Let's go back to romantic writing and so on. How do you actually motivate yourself? Or is it just a case of, well, you just let the ideas flow?
You know, I am fascinated by people. I'm one course shy of a psychology minor, but I went into business. But I went into business figuring out how to sell products to people, how to package them and everything. So my husband loves the action genre. So when I watch an action film, I'm like, wow, I would really like to put that person into a romance. Like one key example is Doctor Strange, the movie Doctor Strange. Benedict Cumberbatch, love him. So I thought, wow, what if I put a surgeon who could no longer perform surgery and he has this big ego as a doctor in a country town? How much could I make him suffer and get some romantic comedy out of all that? So that's kind of the way my mind works. So while everyone's going kapow and blowing stuff up, I'm thinking about how can I use this this type of character in a romance?
I dread to think what you make of Captain America or indeed other sort of major sort of alliance at that point. I mean, Steve Rogers, he's already got his romantic troubles with Peggy. I mean, let's face it, you know, time in all sorts of ways. We're also been connected with Rebecca Bond from Norwich, of course, a very romantic part of England. Rebecca, any thoughts or questions you'd like to put to our potty trained expert, Melinda? Sorry, I won't mention the potty again, but it's just awesome.
I'd love to. You mentioned there that you're, you know, inspired and fascinated by people. Would you say that that's what inspires you to write? Do you find that you incorporate people you meet or people you're inspired by into your stories?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I have a very large family because people in my family got married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced. And so we have a very large extended family. And as you know, people go through life and no faulting people, but things happen. You know, like my brother fell in love with this woman and fell out of love with her. And they ended up having a child together, you know, and that's wonderful fodder for me as an author, because I can see firsthand the emotional struggles that they're going through. But I like to write everything with a little bit of humor so I can, because that's the way I look at the world. So I can twist that a little bit and make the story unique. So it's not really their story, but it is something that happens to people, you know, all around the world. You fall in love, you think this is your person. And then as you grow, it doesn't quite work out.
And I love that. I think it's important to, you know, write about all the aspects of love, because it isn't always, you know, this fairy tale story, is it? And I think it's good that you've incorporated, you know, in a humorous way too, because we have to see the bright side of everything, I think. So I love that you put into writing. I think that's fantastic.
Thanks. And when you talk about fairy tale stories, what other fairy tale story could you actually have than our singer-songwriter and school teacher? I mean, if that's not a grist for an extra romantic novel, Melinda, I don't know what is. It's Chloe Rose. How are you, Chloe?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
We're waiting for the world to end. We could go back to the place where the sky is falling down, down. I'll be around when the sky is falling down. I'll see this through when the light is almost out. I'll shelter you when the sky. At the window, scared what you might see. 'Cause we're waiting for the world to end. Will we see this to the end? When the sky is falling down, down.
When you're writing your songs, which are quite romantic, let's face it, and it's only a matter of hours before your latest song is released, of course, little plug once again for the joys of The Sky is Falling. Don't worry, Melinda, it's nothing to do with Chicken Little. We've identified that. But Chloe, would you like to just explain the kind of background to this very romantic thing, which we'll be editing into the interview, so Melinda and the listener will be able to hear once again To Sky is Falling. What was the inspiration you chose for this one?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's based on a romantic story about two people being in love with each other, wanting to spend the rest of their life with each other. But it's kind of, it's dramatic. It's about coming to the end of the world, really. And it's about that person being by your side till the end. And that's basically what the concept is. I know it sounds dramatic, but hopefully people love it. And I was looking at Melinda's work because, you know, she writes the romantic novels as well. And this is something that interests me, Alex. So I like to write this way, and she writes it as well. Very nice.
There you go. You see, it crosses over so many wonderful things. And of course, Melinda, you've had huge success. I mean, Dandelion Wishes was made into the television movie Love in Harmony Valley with Amber Marshall. How did that feel when you saw your words translated into a TV movie?
I don't want to sound sappy, but I cried. We were on the set for 2 days. And the first day, I recognized none of my words, you know, and I was just, you know,
what have you done to my babies?
I was thrilled that, you know, it was happening and everything, but I wasn't really touched. And then the second day we saw the romantic moment at the end of the film being filmed. And those were my words. And I turned to my husband, and my editor was there also. And I was like, those are my words, you know, just like that tightness in your chest that you're just really in awe. And Amber Marshall is so fantastic. You know, you guys probably know her from Heartland. She's a fantastic actress. I mean, she just kind of drops into the zone and, you know, can make herself cry. And I just was in awe of her.
And all this with no sign of Benedict Cumberbatch whatsoever. So, you know, it proves you don't necessarily have to have Benedict in the whole system from that line of things. Jessica has now returned back to us. And again, with commendable honesty. I mean, it's almost like George Washington-esque honesty. She actually just typed in, "I'm so sorry, my computer just randomly shut off, charged battery and everything." It's all right, Jessica, you're back with us now. What questions do you have for Melinda?
Well, now that I'm back, I'm very curious. So I know with a lot of romance, people are kind of like, oh, these characters, like, their chemistry was so good and it can really make or break a romance. I'm very curious how you go about making your characters really have that, like, bond that can really portray them as an accurate couple.
You know, I think it's different with every book. And I've written so many, I don't want to date myself, but that there are some books where it comes easier and some books where it comes harder. I know that I take inspiration, like I said, from other places, you know, and that sometimes helps. But it also, as a psychology nerd, again, it helps to know how that one person speaks to the soft, mushy inner part of you. Like, we all have our wounds. We've all been hurt in some way. We're all imperfect in some way. It's not that we all need therapy, but there is that one person who can truly understand you. And also, relationships are about kind of growing and changing and forming together, you know? So those people that can move with you. I have a friend of mine, I love her to death. And she was widowed in her 20s. And she has become such a person. It would be so interesting to write her love story, because she's become so set in her ways now in her 30s that, you know, I almost think you would have to be a prince. You'd have to be, you know, a prince to win her love, right?
Rise, basically.
So it's very interesting.
More chronologically gifted, standards continue to rise, Melinda. That's the key thing.
Maybe you know about that, Alex. I don't know.
I'm not an expert at this at all. I'm just intrigued by, again, showing that the amazing ways in which you can raise three children and with your partner, obviously, with your husband doing the soccer thing, the karate thing, the dance thing, the little league thing, and, of course, the basketball thing. Is that a thing, Melinda?
Oh, there's a thing for everything, right? You guys have your football over there, you know, which is our soccer over here. But we are right in the middle of right now, March Madness, which is nothing is being done around the house. My husband just retired from teaching last year. And so this has been his project, this house. But nothing is being done as the matches are being played. It's kind of like the World Cup, right? The World Cup, nothing is done in countries where soccer is king while the World Cup is going on. Am I right?
You could say that's a fair summation of the whole sort of system, basically. I mean, you know, we haven't quite got into it as yet, but, you know, it is happening, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So as to raising three kids and doing the thing, there are super moms out there all the time, you know, working in grocery stores, you know, waitressing, juggling the demands of, you know, parenting and doing everything, and then reaching for their dreams on the side. Like Chloe may know, you know, writing songs might not be her paying gig right now, but it supplements her incomes, and it makes her a better person because she is truly reaching out for her dreams.
Oh, absolutely. Good luck. Oh, thank you, Melinda. You're doing awesome.
Oh. Rebecca, back to yourself again. Any further questions you'd like to put about these wonderful texts that are around just in time for Mother's Day, of course? Well, actually, Mother's Day next year, presumably, as opposed to we're reading from a slightly dated press release here. That's Mother's Day 2022. Rebecca, over to you.
Yeah, I'm interested to know, Melinda, why you why you're inclined to write romance. Is it just something you enjoy to read? Is it something you've always just had a fascination with? You know, you've mentioned your fascination with people and psychology. Is that the inspiration behind the genre?
I think I have always liked justice, movies with justice being served, you know, or happy endings. I don't like so-called romances. I mean, a romance by definition has a happy ending at the end. So there are some movies where one person is alone but has had a lovely romantic experience, which to me is not a romance. There's something really satisfying for me about that. I mean, I could watch other movies and be like, well, why couldn't they let this person have a happy ending, right? I mean, in Harry Potter, why did they all, you know, why did some of the really interesting, lovable characters have to die? Tell me that. Why?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. But I think with romance especially, I do like to see a happy ending. But sometimes, if, you know, a less happy ending is quite interesting. But definitely with romance, I do like to see things turn out okay. But as we've talked about a little bit, I do also like to see, you know, the ups and downs as well, because as we've said, it isn't always perfect, is it? So I like the humorous approach to, you know, the ups and downs of a relationship and, you know, eventually reaching that happy ending or however it ends up for the characters.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen There's a movie called The Five Bloods by Spike Lee. Have you guys seen this movie?
I haven't actually.
It doesn't, I'm not going to spoil anything by saying it doesn't end with everybody having a happy ending.
It certainly doesn't, Melinda.
But there are satisfying endings, and the heart of the film, kind of like Samwise Gamgee, you know, in Lord of the Rings, he was the heart of the film, right? And so the person that is the heart of the film has, you know, what we would call a traditional happy ending.
It's interesting you mentioned The Five Bloods, which is available, of course, on Netflix, because let's face it, it wasn't going to get a theatrical release in the current COVID climate. But in terms of what Spike Lee did there, clearly he's relating to the Vietnam War. And again, no spoilers, but obviously a group of people who were bonded there go back to Vietnam, peacetime, etc. I'm intrigued, actually, were there any of those characters, a bit like Benedict Cumberbatch's Doctor Strange, you think, I'll just be working on getting that character out of there and write a romance around them?
I would, well, probably if characters from that that movie came into one of my books, there would be the one, it's, you know, it's no secret that they're going to Vietnam to recover gold that they found while they were on a tour of duty there. So there would be, you know, a supporting character who was that character seeking the gold, right? It's same as the movie, like in, what is the, is it the third National Treasure movie with Nicolas Cage?
Oh, where his classics of that time, Melinda. I mean, almost Shakespearean, yes. Perhaps.
I love the classic, right? So, yeah, so his parents were, both his mom and his dad were in that film, right? So I think I would put them more as supporting characters. You know, you do have to, when you create story or when you create a song that has a message or a story to it, you have to have a story engine, like what is moving the story along. So I think a treasure hunt would be a really interesting one.
Well, I mean, looking at where to start with Melinda Curtis books, Can't Hurry Love, Dream a Little Dream, Sealed with a Kiss. I'm sensing a musical theme here, Melinda. And that's just actually taken from the Sunshine Valley series. You know, is this something you think, now there's a good tune. I'll just write a theme for that.
No, I mean, I don't even... I had nothing to do with those titles. I love those titles. And I'm going to flash a cover of Dream a Little Dream because it's just adorable. I mean, you have this cute little French bulldog. And that whole series is, speaking of rom-coms, it's every book in the series starts with three elderly widows playing poker to decide who they're going to match in their small town. So there's... You know, there's
like a Scottish play.
But I do love that the publisher thought that, you know, they could have these song titles. I really love that. I'm a cover slut. I don't know about you guys. Like when a book has a really great title and an interesting cover, I just pick it up, you know, and take it home. I want to see what it's all about.
Yeah, well, of course, you should never judge a book by its cover, even if it's got a cute little puppy on it. I mean, much as we like Dream a Little Dream, I mean, it's the quality of your writing. Or is it fair to say that that little cute puppy on the cover is key and intrinsic to the narrative and plot?
He is key to the story. He is key to the story. The heroine has been left a little French bulldog who has separation anxiety issues because his owner has passed away. And she's a judge, and so she has to carry him in his little anxiety jacket into the courtroom, and then he, you know, makes horrible sounds, you know, comedic sounds.
Does he leave any kind of commentary on the actual courtroom drama by possibly leaving a little gift, or is that too much delving into the plot, basically?
No, puppies are prone. No potty humor, yes, was used in that book, Alex. There you go.
Okay. Perfectly well. I think already a winner with respect to that, just by the pounce that Chloe, Jessica, and Rebecca were sharing when they said, oh, it's a puppy with separation anxiety. Jessica, any other questions you'd like to add?
I could ask, I'm curious, what's your favorite fictional couple if you had to choose just one?
Oh my gosh, I think it's Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. I just love anytime anyone redoes that story, I'm in to see it. Cheesy, you know, cheesy 80s 90s remakes, the whole works.
So it's not just
whole, like frenemies. Sorry.
Yeah, frenemies is a great trope.
Okay. Chloe, any thoughts or questions for yourself? I know originally when we were talking about Melinda, for some reason I thought she was a children's writer. No, obviously romance. It's easily put together. Chloe, over to you. I think it was back to the potty seat on the airplane, Melinda. I was confused for a moment, but still.
I'm interested to know the characters, the main characters. Do you base those characters on people that you already know? Have you ever based a character on yourself in your story? You know, do you base it around things you've experienced or just stories that you've heard as well? I know obviously lots of ideas will be your own, but I'm intrigued to know where your characters come from.
You know, I'm going to give away a little secret. You can learn a lot about an author by reading their books as to who they are or what they're going through. It's really hard as you're writing a romance not to bring in some of the emotional stuff that you're going through. For example, I wrote a book called Summer Kisses about a man who was busy building a winery, but at the same time, his grandfather who had raised him was falling ill and passing away, and he could not let him go. I mean, he was having a really hard time. He was the one who was saying, it's going to be okay, you know, next year we're going to do this or whatever. And at the same time, my husband was losing the first person he had to lose in his life, who was his older sister, who was dying of throat cancer. And he was the one in the family who was saying this, you know, and it started to come into my writing. And when I noticed it, because you do notice it when you go back and you read it, you're like, oh, wow, you know, take a step back for a moment. But then I just kind of like went full bore with it of, you know, this is the journey that people do go on, you know. So as there's this lighthearted kind of comedic romance going on, the underpinnings that the characters are going through can be, you know, quite emotional. And I think it's really touching when it comes from an authentic place, when it's your experience or someone close to you.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I'm sure that comes through your writing as well. And that's probably why a lot of people are hooked to your stories, because they think, gosh, it seems so real. And that's because you were talking from a place of experience as well. So yes. Really interesting. Thank you.
Yes. I hope you bring some of that strong emotion to your work. I mean, it sounds like you do.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why I was so intrigued to know if you did the same. And brilliant. I fancy reading it myself. So there you go. Dream a little dream. I certainly will.
We've obviously got the Mountain Monroes. We've got the kissing test, the kissing series. We've even got the Joys of the Mountain Firefighters, which is there, which clearly features a fairly rugged individual on the front cover from that point of view. I wouldn't judge that book by the cover at all, Melinda. Surely that's up there. And of course, coming very soon, or actually to be out now, we've got the Blackwell Sisters and the Return of the Blackwell Sisters. How do you actually, I mean, you are a machine, Melinda. I mean, this output that's actually there, it's prodigious. How do you actually sort of motivate yourself from that point of view? Is it just a case of, right, we're on the Blackwells today. No, we've moved on to Mountain Firefighters. Is there a kind of a master plan that you've got in place here?
I don't think there's a master plan. I love strategy games. I love strategy when I was in the corporate world, like figuring things out, figuring out puzzles. You know, I was a word puzzle person as a kid. So for me, when I happened to be published by three different publishers, and I kind of fell into it because I'm really good at the pitch. And so what happens is then I pitch these books and I very naively walk away and say, okay, so I'm probably not going to hear from them for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months or whatever. But then they come back and they're like, oh yeah, this is great, because I've learned how to pitch my work, you know? So the next thing for me that I'm trying to figure out is, okay, so how do I pitch more stuff like to Netflix, you know, or production companies, film production companies, that I won't have to actually do the work.
strategize, that's the way. I mean, we've got the Harmony Valley series, the Bridesmaid series, the Holiday Romances, the Breaking the Rules series. It's amazing. Creating unforgettable characters, a whole range of sort of elements within that. Where would you recommend people should start if they're saying, I want to find out about Melinda Curtis? Do you start at the very beginning, or is it like the Star Trek series where you think, I just don't know where to begin?
That is true about the Star Trek series, or I don't know where to continue, right?
That's true, exactly.
So yeah, each book I write, I try to make it stand alone. But I write along a spectrum. So the things that I write for, like Mills and Boone's Harlequin, are very emotional with lighter tones. So Kissed by the Country Doc, which is the book that was based on Doctor Strange, is the first Monroe book. And it kind of explains, hey, these people inherited a small town in remote Idaho in the middle of nowhere. You know, now what happens? So that's kind of like the emotional lighthearted. And then the Dream a Little Dream, Can't Hurry Love, Poker Playing Matchmakers, I get more comedy in them, you know. So that's kind of, if that's your jam, then I would start with Can't Hurry Love, which is the first book in the series. And then The Kissing Test is like my most recent full-on rom-com stuff, you know, where there's lots of more comedy, more slapstick, more impossible kind of situations. So if you're into that, then I would start with what is that? A Kiss Is Just a Kiss is the first one. Oh, and look, and that's a movie title.
Absolutely. You could have Chloe Rose writing the music for the movie. In fact, we'll give you a chance to actually have a listen to some of her stuff.
That would be awesome.
That would be amazing.
Rebecca, any final questions?
I'll have to write about a songwriter.
I think so. Based in a seaside town, basically, in Cleethorpes, with a fondness for fish.
Yeah, Cleethorpes.
Very good. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, awesome.
Rebecca, any final questions for yourself?
Yeah, you partly answered my question there, Melinda, about the idea of having a series instead of standalone books. I was just interesting as to whether they just happened to become series the more you sat down and wrote the books, or whether you decided you had your heart set on making them a series. But did you mention there they do work as standalone books?
Yeah, they do work as standalone books. But I do try to have an overriding thread. For Harlequin, Mills and Boone, I made the mistake of pitching a 12 book series.
Oh my again word.
I'm my own worst enemy. Every third or fourth book you wrap up some of the storylines, but then there's the thread that goes through the whole thing. But it is, I mean, readers get hooked, right? They get hooked with characters. And so it's easier for them to come back if it's the same community that they're in, or they're interested in someone finally getting their romance, you know, their happily ever after.
It
sounds like they're fantastic, and I will at some point get my hands on them. They sound really, really interesting. But I think it's great to know that if you're really going to enjoy that first book, that there's more to go on to. And as you say, you do get attached to the characters, the storyline, you know, the whole atmosphere of it. And I think that's great that you can then carry that on and really get immersed in your series. So I'm looking forward to getting my hands on them.
Cool.
We started off by Melinda, by talking about the Fab Four courses. So we've spoken to Anna and Carly beforehand in terms of that collection of authors that are putting together this combination of Second Chance for Love. That, of course, is available in terms of finding out the joys of four women discovering a second chance for love when they finally meet their finally happily ever after partners in an anthology of romance. We've still got Thankfully in Love, which we've also spoken about. And presumably, folk who are interested in just yourself, MelindaCurtis.net would be the place to actually go to for further updates and details and so on.
Right. And there's a welcome page too on there that you can click on that says, hey, are you new to me? Where should I start? And then it kind of summarizes what I just went through. You know, absolutely. If you're looking for this kind of story, start here.
Go to the website, listen to the podcast. It's all working together. How was the vaccination, by the way?
The vaccination was easy peasy. And thank you for being a little bit flexible.
Flexibility is our middle name. That's what we actually worked through on this point of view. Two critical final questions for you, though. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
Oh, no, it's been really interesting. You guys are all so charming. I just want to sit down and have some cheap and cheerful wine or drink some tea.
Well, you know, tea, of course, is Jessica's second name in so many ways, particularly sweet tea. I don't know if have you followed the sweet tea saga, or indeed sweet tea and boiled peanuts? Does that make it to Oregon? Or is it a case of nowhere in Oregon, we couldn't possibly have sweet tea or indeed boiled peanuts?
I do know about sweet tea because I lived for a year in Georgia. So, you know, experience the South. but did not do the whole boiled peanuts thing. Is it resurfacing now, or what's the deal?
It's always been around. You drive on any road kind of towards the not towards the states, but kind of the further south you go, the more road stands you see with boiled peanuts. So next time you're in Georgia, you have to try some.
Yeah, I don't know. I think sometimes Jessica just gets carried away, really. It's just, you know, where we're going to with these Southern recipes. It's just too much.
It just doesn't sound like it would be good. And I think that's probably why I don't remember stopping to do it. Because
run away from the boiled peanuts. So the final question, Melinda, will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back and join us sometime in the not too distant future?
Oh, of course. Of course.
Melinda Curtis, no relation presumably to Bernard Schwartz or Tony Curtis, or indeed Jamie Lee Curtis. Just wanted to clarify that.
Sorry.
There was an action hero back in the day, of course. We salute you. And Chloe, Jessica and Rebecca, sticking around for another little piece with another Zoomer and so on. Melinda, keep on writing. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Melinda.
Now, Easter. Obviously coming around the corner, sorting its way through in all sorts of ways, despite the pandemic and so on. You can't actually abandon Easter, of course not. And of course, when it comes to Easter, we might be thinking about the resurrection, or even perhaps equally significant, the great Easter egg debate. Do you smash it? Do you split it? Or do you put it in the fridge? Well, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals to actually talk with respect to this whole side of things. First of all, psychologist, the wonderful Donna Dawson. How are you, Donna?
Well, Jack, how are you?
Excellent. And we also have the fantastic Tani Holtam, who's head of Easter at Asda, which is wonderful. I mean, this is very good. A significant role indeed to actually have in place.
Hi, Alex. Nice to meet you.
Okay. Donna, let's turn to you first, because clearly there was an old line in terms of how do you eat your particular egg and so on. Do you start from the top? Do you go to the middle? But it seems as though there's a whole smorgasbord of ways forward in terms of how eggs can be eaten. Is this a new example of human psychology at work?
Well, I mean, food research with personality have been going on for about 70 years, because if you think about it, our personalities develop through social interaction. And our first social interaction is eating. It's around food, first with our mothers and then around a table. And as infants, we sit around and watch other people eat, and we make subconscious decisions about how we're going to interact with food. Some of those habits stay with us for life. Others we modify as we grow older. One of the things that kids like to do is to split their egg up into lots of pieces, what I would call the eggsploder. And oddly enough, that was the main type that came out in the Asda research. 93% of those interviewed did fit into these five egg-eating personality types. Now, the exploder will smash their egg to smithereens. They'll grab and eat random pieces. Any smaller eggs will be gobbled up. They tend to be spontaneous, impulsive types who don't like routine and who get bored easily. They're constantly on the lookout for adventure and surprise. They go at life full tilt. They let their enthusiasm lead the way, and they're impatient to reach their goals. So they experience pleasure as soon and as often as possible. Now, that was number one. And I have to say, I thought, wow, that's quite a few people, 29%, that fit into that category. And it did occur to me that some of us might be reverting to this childhood habit of smashing because of lockdown, because we're impatient to get to the goodies, we're frustrated, you know, we want our pleasure now. So I would be very interested to do this survey in a year's time to see if we're not in lockdown, whether there would be as many exploders. But in second place, we had a wonderful egg splitter. And this is where they use the seam of the egg to break or cut into two halves. Now, these tend to be more practical, no-nonsense types who excel at summing up people and situations. They're good judgment. They ask, they're often asked for advice by their friends, and they aim for balance in their lives. So they can save their pleasure for a rainy day, but they also like to have a little for now. In third place, we have the refrigerators. Now, these people put their eggs in the fridge before eating, and they wait till they get chilled. I would classify these as more discerning, sophisticated type personalities who have very firm ideas about what they like. They set their own trends, they enjoy luxury, and they're able to defer their pleasure if by waiting they can make it even better. In fourth place, we have the cautious excavators. They break their egg into very small pieces, eat them bit by bit, and they hoard any smaller eggs they find. So they tend to be more cautious and thoughtful, good with detail, like to plan ahead, anticipate consequences. They don't like surprises. They're conscientious and caring, but they think pleasure should be earned. Once earned, they will enjoy every minute of it and they'll try to stretch it out. And in last place, the extremers, they bite into their egg as if it were an apple. They tend to be eccentric, independent types who do their own thing, don't worry about what other people think of them. They tend to have an artistic flair. They tend to be easygoing and tolerant. And they will aim to create pleasure to be enjoyed in the moment. So you have those five types, and you also have crossovers between different types. So it makes for a much bigger range.
Yeah, I was thinking about in terms of obviously blended egg eaters. I mean, the one thing that sort of strikes me about Donna is it kind of relates very much to, I suppose, the marshmallow test, which was, I'm sure you're familiar with it in terms of psychological experiments, that children were given marshmallows and then sort of promised if they deferred their gratification. Could this actually be the equivalent of the 21st century marshmallow analysis?
Yeah, you're talking about the refrigerators who are able to wait.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, you know, some of these habits we develop as children stay with us, and others get modified by life experiences. And I'm wondering whether lockdown, as I said earlier, has made us revert back to a type that we might not be normally. I mean, maybe normally we're like an egg splitter or an excavator, but lockdown's made us more impatient. And so when we get something like an egg that can be smashed up, maybe we're doing that now more than ever before. So, you know, people change depending on what's happening around them as well.
I've got to ask the question, Tani, what kind of person do you actually fall into? Are you an egg splitter? Are you a refrigerator? Are you a blended soul? Are you indeed an excavator?
I am an excavator. I like to take my time and pick off bit by bit and savour it, and little and often throughout the day rather than eating it all at once.
So Alex, what have you decided you are?
Well, I think I'm probably an egg splitter, actually. Well, kind of mixture between egg splitter and refrigerator, really, in terms of those side of things. In that sense, I'm sort of saying, is it possible to have a blended hybridization of egg scenario here?
Why not create your own individual eating experience? And I found that a lot of the radio presenters today have been egg splitters. And it's interesting that being an egg splitter tends to go along with good judgment and sizing up people and situations straight away, which I think all radio presenters do need. But what was interesting in the ASDA survey is that more than half of us don't like the way other people eat their eggs. We don't like the sound of it. We don't like to watch them. And we certainly don't want to see them licking their fingers.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to mention, Donna, because clearly wearing my sort of general consumer-based hat, I was thinking this also ties into do folk who get so irritated by folk who actually eat popcorn in cinemas, etc. Back in the day, of course, where we could go to cinemas, but that's another line entirely. But it is interesting in terms of that whole notion about somebody getting irritated by the sound of someone eating an Easter egg.
Yes. Yeah. As you say, I think we all think our own eating habits are fine, and that's just a kind of human quirk. But the other added factor, as you mentioned earlier, was that if we're thrown together with people for long periods of time, as we have been in lockdown, we can get annoyed by little things that they do, such as their eating habits. So it might be an idea to take your special Easter egg away to your private place and eat it in secret.
Although, having said that, we don't want to actually get into the notion of teaching our elderly relatives to suck eggs on this particular one, because that'll be a different line entirely.
This Easter, I'm giving them permission to suck their egg if they want to.
Well, it is a way forward. I mean, were you surprised by any of the findings, Tani, from your own perspective within the ASDA Easter research?
I think it's just really interesting that you can get an instinct of someone's personality by the way that they eat their eggs. I'll definitely be on the lookout this weekend to watch people eat their eggs so I can know a bit more about them anyway.
Now, clearly, we've got, obviously, the Feast of Passover. We've got the whole festival scenario here. We've got the Christian festival, the aspects that relate to that. We've got the resurrection. We've got hot cross bunnies. We've got the Easter bunny. What is it about Easter that kind of, you know, is it the rebirth of spring, the cycle of spring? Is that something which you feel is actually sort of unique across humanity, Donna?
I certainly think so. And spring, particularly this year, when we need hope. is the kind of symbol of hope, isn't it? Spring renewal, starting of a new season, when the weather gets better, the days get longer, the sun shines more. The sun does a lot to raise people's spirits, as it did yesterday. And I think we're all disappointed it's not really shining much today. But yes, it's a symbolic of hope and new beginnings. And we all want a new beginning now, and we all want to hang on to hope. So there is something deeply psychologically encouraging about Easter, whatever your religious beliefs might be and whatever your confectionery tastes may be. I think for all of us, it is a time of hope, renewal, and new beginnings.
And I have to ask the question as well, Tani, obviously ahead of Easter, is there ahead of Christmas, ahead of Halloween, and ahead of other sort of holiday
She's
festivals?
She's all those things, aren't you, Tani? Wraps into one.
Yeah, so actually there's two of us that share what we call seasonal confectionery. So we have an Easter and a Christmas buyer, and then a buyer that specialises in Halloween, Mother's Day, Father's Day, and Valentine's and those kinds of events.
I mean, it must be agony actually having to make a decision, Tani, in terms of, do we go with this brand of chocolate? Do we go with that brand of chocolate? Presumably you do have to take a taste test.
Absolutely. That's the best part of being a chocolate buyer, right? You get to taste all the products and decide which one you think is going to do the best.
And of course, we all know that the sun always shines in Yorkshire. So as to being founded in Yorkshire, obviously sort of has a head start on that basis, which is fantastic. Donna, I mean, final questions. You've asked us, but what kind of Easter egg consumer are you?
Oh, well, first of all, I just wanted to say to Tani, I think I'm in the wrong job. I think I'd rather be with her tasting chocolate. But I'm an egg splitter. I'll use the seam of the egg to break or cut the egg into two halves, and then I'll break it into smaller pieces. I probably don't eat it all at once. So I might be a little bit of a hoarder there. So maybe an excavator deep down. And I might even stick it in the fridge. Oh, my goodness, that's three types. That's very complicated.
Yeah, I mean, we could always actually sort of have another little challenge in terms of trying to identify celebrities with what they might be. I mean, for instance, the former president of the United States, I would have said, could definitely have been an exploder, but that's just the line entirely, you know?
I think you're absolutely right. It's interesting, Alex, that in 1997, they discovered a gene called a novelty-seeking gene, which links personality with certain foods. So you've got a very impulsive personality that's exploratory, that's impatient, that takes risks. And they also like, more than most people, things like alcohol, red meat, spicy foods, and coffee. So you see how food and personality can interact.
Clearly, it's a whole new meaning, Donna, to the term, we are what we eat.
Indeed.
That's another discussion.
We have to watch that one.
Tani, where would you suggest people should go to find out further details about this Asda-based survey and more?
So if you're wanting to get your Easter eggs, I'd advise getting into store before the weekend starts. But if you're wanting to find a bit more about what kind of Easter egg what your personality says about you, the way you eat your Easter egg, then I would go on to Asda.com, where we've done a full write-up for you to have a look.
Tani Holtom, head of Easter at Asda, and of course, ace psychologist extraordinaire, Donna Dawson. Keep on keeping on, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon, and happy Easter vacations, folks.
Thank you, Alex. Happy Easter to you.
Thank you.
If you happen to be one of the many people who suffer with vision impairment and so on, it's very important to actually have all the assistance one can get with respect to technology. And indeed, there is a new form of technology that's actually working. Actually, it's not so new these days, because most of us are actually used to personalised helpers called Alexa. Yep, there we are. It's also opened up a whole range of things with devices around the system here. And actually to talk about how indeed Alexa is actually helping with respect to the Royal National Institute of Blind People and a whole heap of others. We're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, disability rights campaigner and motivational speaker, the fantastic Dr. Amit Patel. How are you, Amit?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And of course, head of advice and customer service at the RNIB, Jamie Dormandy. How are you, Jamie?
Hello, Alex. Very well, thank you.
Jamie, if we can come to you first, just talk us through this latest aspect in terms of how Alexa, we mentioned it again, can obviously sort of help with respect to really ensuring that we all have a level playing field when it comes to activities and so on, despite the different systems that we actually work within.
So we are, RNIB have been working with Amazon on a number of Alexa features for the last few years. And actually, I can hear her being
this
set off
true,
there.
This is true, exactly.
So apologies. that tends to happen.
It happens to the Joy. That no worries whatsoever. It proves that it's live. So carry on.
Indeed. And the latest of those features enables people to contact RNIB's helpline directly by saying, Alexa, call RNIB helpline. So simply by uttering that command with a device in the room, users will be connected to an advisor at RNIB's helpline without any other technology or telephones or anything else involved, directly through to an advisor, giving access to RNIB's services such as talking books, discussion and support groups, practical advice about anything to do with sight loss, from social distancing to employment to education.
Mm. And Amit, from your own perspective, this can only be to everybody's benefit, really. It actually ensures that people who are differently enabled effectively can actually sort of have, as I said, more of a level playing field, but they can also participate in some of the things which many sighted people can take for granted.
Absolutely. Sometimes, you know, trying to get the information you need isn't as easy as you think, especially being visually impaired. You know, even being able to access the internet, being able to use screen readers, all of that takes skills. You know, you need to learn how to use all of this. To be able to just say, Alexa, call the RNIB helpline and get put through to someone who can actually help you with, you know, understanding technology, can help you with peer support, can help you with any questions you have regarding your sight loss journey that you may be on, or maybe there's a member of the family in your household who's going through sight loss and you're not quite sure how to help them. So, you know, the key here is information, and the fact that the RNIB and Amazon have come together and collaborated on getting the information out there a lot easier, it's only a good thing.
And there are some other bonus features that also come across, which I'm sure is well worth noting. I mean, I'm interested in the screen magnifier, the voice view screen reader, and of course the opportunity to actually ask Alexa to speak slower or faster, depending on what your needs happen to be.
Absolutely. And one of the best features I actually use a lot in my house is the show and tell. And basically I can hold up a package of food. It could be a can or a box food, and ask Alexa to actually look at it using its camera and actually tell me what I'm holding. So is it a can of baked beans? Is it a can of custard? You know, and it's basically being my eyes, without me having to go and rely on anybody else or getting any other tech to be able to do it, and just simply ask the device, what am I holding? So it's everyday use. But I think the big benefit of this is it's not a device that's made specifically for disabled people. It's a device that's made for everybody, that is accessible and inclusive of your disability. And that's the key here, because gadgets and tech for disabled people are so expensive and sometimes out of reach for so many people. But to be able to go and buy a product, turn it on and connect it to a Wi-Fi signal, and then it talks to you, it can communicate using the screen or verbally, but you can actually access the information out there like everybody else. And that, to me, is amazing.
Jamie, this is the stuff of science fiction of the 1950s, 1960s and 70s. We're living that dream now. I mean, we're engaging in a connection via Zoom at present. Is this something which, as Amit's just said there, because of its affordability, is really something which is going to be ubiquitous and will roll out? I mean, I can't imagine even the best trained guide dog ever could actually tell its owner what it was actually holding in its hand, at least not in a kind of language it could understand.
Indeed, the price point is key, and to be able to pick one of these up for less than £50 makes it much more available to people. And certainly in the past, you mentioned sort of the decades gone by, accessibility and inclusion for everyone was often an afterthought in the design process, and therefore specialist technology has sort of been developed that retrofits onto the mainstream technology, and that can often be really costly because it's catering to a relatively small part of the market. However, with these devices, they're mainstream, actually they're designed for everybody, inclusive of people with disabilities and people with sight loss, and that's what makes them attractive and actually usable in a home setup by the whole family.
It's always notable as well that you can always turn the volume down or indeed switch the machine off if you wish to, as we should have done right at the start of this particular thing. Otherwise, poor Alexa gets very confused and goes all over the place, really. But never mind. Life continues. I mean, Aman, do you think this is the sort of start of all sorts of rollout things? I mean, we're talking now about, obviously, the things that can actually happen. Would you anticipate within the next few years that things will get even easier and more beneficial for folk as technology continues to sort of impact on our everyday existences?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I live with tech every day. I think tech is getting cheaper, it's getting smaller, it's getting more user-friendly. But I think companies need to think about how everybody can access tech. And I think it's one of these things that it's, you know, tech is only going to make our lives, I think, simple. It's gonna make it a little bit easier, but it just needs to be thought through. And I think that's the problem. I think a lot of, you know, you start retrofitting or having to buy aftermarket things to try and make your device work for you. That's when it gets complicated. For me, I like it simple. You know, I like to be able to ask a question and get verbal response back. I like, you know, I use a Braille keyboard. I use a device that reads printed documents for me. So tech for me is a huge thing. But it needs to be accessible. It needs to be available, and it needs to be at an affordable price.
Yeah, absolutely. Keeping it simple, the absolute essence of all the kind of bits and pieces, because we are essentially fairly basic individuals. We just want the sort of simple things in life, and it does work. Jamie, where can people go to find out further details? Or do we just say, Alexa, tell me where we can go to find further details?
Indeed. So if you have a device, you can say, Alexa, call our RLIB helpline, and you'll be put through directly to one of our advisors. If you don't, and you would like information about using voice activated devices for people with vision impairment, or actually any other form of information, advice, guidance, connection to peer support, then you can call the RLIB helpline on 0303 123 9999, and we're open Monday to Friday 8 till 8, and Saturday 1 till 9. Also, our website rnib.org.uk will give you more information.
And I also know that people have even used that wonderful device to even sort of listen to this particular radio program as well, as far away as different countries of the world, such as Wales as well. Marvellous stuff. Dr. Amit Patel, disability rights campaigner and motivational speaker, and Jamie Dormandy, head of advice and customer service at the RNIB. Huge thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you.